I tried to do like a fun one.
It was a fun one.
Did you hear it?
Fun. Yeah, I could hear it. It was just a little soft. You know, it's like a little. Just leave all of this. Hello and welcome to Left on Red. It's me, Alice, and I'm joined by Riley. How's it going?
I had chili just now, and you're about to, and I think that's cool.
Yeah, I think we're like maybe experiencing a kind of strangeness of time and a shared relation between the fact that we both coincidentally had chili today that is going to really sort of like set us on a strange course to the uncanny.
Would you suggest that what has actually occurred, especially since that chili has been consumed across a national border, is that we have experienced the kind of liminality and alienation that Rivera Garza writes about in her various novellas?
I absolutely would. And you know what? I think maybe we even like consumed the same chili at different points in the multiverse.
This didn't really feel as much magical realism. It felt more like psychological fantasy.
I'll introduce it first.
Go ahead.
We're back at it again with Christina Rivera Garza, because I read two of her books back to back. I read The Tega Syndrome, and I read the subject of today's episode, The Iliac Crest.
Jumping in for a sec, you may be wondering, hey, didn't they say they were going to talk about George Saunders' A Swim in the Pond in the Rain? We are. It's just that that book is very long.
It's a lot of work, yes. The Iliac Crest,
I was on vacation for a while. You also may wonder, hey, is this episode very late? I was on vacation for a while, so we're doing The Iliac Crest, and then Swim in the Pond in the Rain will come next.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and The Iliac Crest, because I had read it a while ago, and it's 100 pages or something. It's a novella. I had it in the back pocket for us to do as a sort of like emergency episode. And so that's what we're doing now. But I'm very excited to talk about it because I think we opened up a lot of discussions talking about the Tega Syndrome, that I feel like this really sort of ties together. And to be honest, of the two novellas, this is the one that I prefer.
So can you just introduce it for a little bit?
Sure.
And also, if you haven't listened to the Tega Syndrome episode, pause this one, go back, listen to that one, because we're mostly going to be responding to and building on stuff we talked about in that episode.
Yeah, I think that would be helpful. So The Iliac Crest, it builds off of Rivera Garza's dissertation, actually, her doctoral dissertation, where she was studying an insane asylum in Mexico under Porfirio Diaz, the early dictator, La Castañeda. And she has sort of fictionalized this into this novella that is, like the Tega Syndrome, confusing, elaborate, sort of contradictory, and fractal. And ostensibly, this is the story of a man, and this is going to complicate every single thing that I say here, who is a doctor at an asylum in an unnamed place, a sort of unnamed dictatorship, who is waiting for his ex-girlfriend, a woman who he has betrayed, right, who he has cheated on, and who opens the door to an entirely different woman who identifies herself as a real, non-fictional Mexican writer of the uncanny called Amparo Davila, and she says, "You're a woman." Fantastic opening. Just generally, like, I know your secret, you're a woman. And I sit back from the place like, "What? Fuck, yeah."
Hey, wait, how did Christina Rivera Garza have access to my private thoughts?
Yes.
This is essentially the basics of the story, right? Is this doctor trying to go back and work out what this Amparo Davila woman is doing in his house, because she doesn't leave, and how it relates to the story of a patient he had in the hospital, which is, again, sort of described as, again, some of the, this also even relates a little bit to Waiting for the Barbarians, right? The way that the institution is described as particularly sort of boringly bloodthirsty.
Yes.
But how that relates to the files of a patient with a political disorder, it was called Juan Escuita.
Juan Escuita, yeah. And who sort of attempts to rally the inmates of this asylum against their doctors and against the sort of program of them being like slowly, neglectfully euthanized, and ultimately like throws himself from a window to his death, which is marked by, again, another sort of recurring thing from the Tega syndrome, little recurring lines that seem to rhyme, where this is written up as like, I don't want to describe what happened next, but I will if they order me, which is sort of like used much later on to sort of essentially to typify gender, right? It's like, I don't want to describe my gender, but I will if they order me to, which is an interesting sort of characterization of it as being like formed within these like authoritarian institutions and bounded by them.
I won't describe what gender I imagine myself as I masturbate, but I will if they order me to.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, this is absolutely right. A sort of a real thing. I mean, this is the Judith Butler thing, right? Is the gender is sort of like a set of things that expresses itself within and against power and in relation to power. It's a way of like using power and being subsumed by power, all of these things. And so too in this, where the first thing that we question about this doctor is his, and it's he, him pronouns throughout, but that's again complicated, is his gender, right? And this really sort of like collapses his whole world immediately, being followed by his house just sort of being occupied by women.
Mm-hmm. So it's because it's not just Amparo Davila, it's also his ex-girlfriend, and the relationship that the two of them build up. Over, there even is sort of Rivera Garza invents almost Tolkien-esque invention of languages between them.
Yeah, well, the men who can't understand women is like another sort of recurring theme, and sort of like the incomprehensibility of a different gender to your own. There's an interesting line, and again, this repeats, right? It's a very mirrored sort of novella, but very, very early on, when this doctor is like sort of waiting for his ex-girlfriend, he has this reflection. I suppose this is something that men will understand and that I don't need to expand upon. To the women, I'll just say that this happens more often than you might think. Fear. You provoke fear. Sometimes we confuse this collapse, this immobility, this disarticulation with desire. And it perfectly reverses itself in the back half of the novel, where much more knowingly, the sort of now changed, now sort of transgendered narrator is like, you know, men don't understand this, but, you know, this happens more often than you might think that men provoke fear.
And so, but these other interesting things, right, like, is that Rivera Garza, and when she's written about in reviews, talks about things like the dissolving of meaning of language, but also really at looking at things like meanings as placing concepts in boxes, and sort of blows that out to looking at hospitals as placing things like life and death in boxes, especially with borders. I mean, this is a novel that is also incredibly concerned with borders between the land and the sea, between two different countries, between man and woman, between all of these things. And every character is constantly crossing borders. You know, the border between healthy and sick, the narrator is committed to the hospital several times over the course of the narrative, as well as, you know, the between people who have people with names and people who don't have names. You know, his ex-girlfriend is referred to only as the betrayed. Juan Escuicha is referred to by his name, but before his name is learned, he's referred to as the impetuous one, the madman who threw himself out of the window into the sea. And even the border between madness and defiance, as it is understood by these kinds of insane institutions. I don't know if
there's a really and through language too. There's a really interesting line that I highlighted as well about Juan Escuicha, right? He says, the impetuous man obstructed their task, they being the orderlies, solely with the act of speech, by speaking to them as if there was still something human within them. And because of that, they hated him more than they hated us, we who cruelly but honestly bestowed on them the treatment of the dead. I've actually misattributed that. He's speaking to the other patients, right? And so he's trying to like sort of break them out of this, this role of patient, and they hate him for it. and he discovers that this is futile.
So I want to talk about like what is the narrator's main want, right? Because even though this is a very, very experimental and quite strange story, right? Just like the want of the detective in the Tega syndrome is to do her job, the want of the narrator is basically to return to normal, to stop being, to have no one know his secret, to not have these women living in his house.
Sure. I think there's also a case of the want being communication. Communication being something that, you know, we'll talk about this when we inevitably do Blindsight, right? But communication requires, like, mutual recognition, right? This is a sort of a situation, the nuances of which will be instantly familiar to you if you have been, for instance, misgendered, as the narrator is, where it's like you're sort of deliberately or accidentally misperceiving part of me in order to, like, hinder our communication. And he goes from this state where he is unable to communicate with these women in his house, who speak a language that is just kind of comprised of sounds.
Oh, I have the quote for that, actually, in front of me. I liked the description of the other language, so I captured it. It was a complete and sophisticated language composed of large grammatical units with a significant sense of repetition, much like the book itself. Its guttural sounds gave the language the feeling of something distantly infantile, of certain round resonances. I was unable to grasp the rest of it, its internal rules, conjugations, or moods. And these are women who, again, in the story, they have made this language over the course of sharing a great deal of private joy over spending every night together, over making very sort of big breakfasts in front of him and sort of always laughing and so on and so on. Mm-hmm. You know, it's very much, this is the, if you want to talk about sort of the book being about differences between men and women, how they experience joy or fear, and also how communication relates to that. You know, the fact that there is a secret language described as infantile and indecipherable is, I think, a big part of that.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, one of the sort of traditional ways in which men have treated women, right? And this is something which is then sort of like later itself reversed and complicated. I think it's also very, very important to talk about medicine at this point. Because medicine is one of the sort of central authoritarian frameworks of the book. You know, we have this divide between doctor and patient. And, you know, initially even, our narrator, the first thing that he sees when this woman comes to his door in the middle of the night is, like, the sort of the bone of her hip, because it's, like, you know, beneath her shirt and above her skirt, and he, like, sort of looks at this, and he feels desire and complication and a kind of, like, disarticulation where he can't think of the name of that bone. And this is where the novel takes its name from. Is, you know, I'm jumping ahead quite a lot, but I think it's you know, it's fine to do that because it's,
you can guess, go through context clues, that that's the name of the bone.
Yes, yeah, the iliac crest. And there's actually a fun little classicist wordplay there where because ilium is one of the names of Troy, so he imagines sort of like Helen of Troy, you know, setting off from this, like, this crested bone. And, you know, the book takes place on sort of like a sea crest as well, so it's all you know, very, very layered. But, like, the ending of the book is the narrator in sort of a new and stranger sense of both gender and role and time, remembering the name of the iliac crest and remembering that, like, this is one of the sort of clearer markers of biological sex, right? A thing which by this point in the book is now absolutely useless. And I really like having that sort of knowledge and the limits of that knowledge really, really sort of like foreground. And that's sort of the punchline of the joke, if you like, is that it is entirely possible to have these scientific hierarchical frameworks for assigning sex and assigning gender. And it has sort of very, very little to do with your actual experience in a lot of ways.
The narrator's transformation throughout the book, which is into sort of this new gender. I mean, the way where I sort of felt it most was that I almost felt the turn. And I don't know if you're going to agree with me here. Was his relationship with the hospital administrator, who was this Lothario seducer character, who steps out of his role as an administrator and then steps into, you know, the narrator's life with these Amparo and his betrayed girlfriend.
Yes, and who is surrounded by sort of luxury, right? And a kind of luxury that makes you feel desire, makes you want to speak to him honestly and disclose things that you wouldn't necessarily do. The whiskey that he offers you tastes delicious, and the cigars that he smokes smell fantastic. And it's a profoundly transgender set of emotions from, as far as I know, a cis woman, about, one of the first things that happens to you when you change your gender, because of, because of authority, because of power. One of the things that you'll notice is men specifically treating you differently. And the kind of change that the administrator makes from being sort of collegial and affable and boss-like to something that's harder to pin down and more seductive and more dangerous in a lot of ways, and ends up getting the narrator sort of committed to this institution, is sort of like, it's really striking to me.
I have the transcription for that as well. It says, I will try to transcribe the dialogue that took place with the general director, the false one refers to the Amparo Davila that arrived at the narrator's house. There is a real one. We'll get into that and the sort of doubling of characters and the disappearances of some. But Amparo Davila, as we've discussed her so far, all you need to know, and the betrayed as faithfully as possible, knowing that by necessity, because of inevitable human limitations, I'll be unfaithful in the deepest sense of the word. The general director arrived on time, as I'd expected, although he wasn't wearing a tie. His body smelled of warm, musky lotion that announced his presence in the halls of the poorly named Serenity Shores Sanatorium. His perfectly shined shoes and gray cashmere socks made his refined taste clear, but the crimson shirt he had chosen for the evening suggested that there were traces of his personality, of his taste, that I wouldn't have predicted. Furthermore, he brought a bottle of whiskey and a flower pot in which a white orchid grew solitary and proud. It was obvious he had a real desire to meet the false one, who I described as beautiful and vulnerable, and he was in pursuit of his prey, making a show of his abilities as a seducer. We all knew it from the start, and all of us, each in our own way, decided to act as though we hadn't noticed. Beautiful view, the seducer said as soon as he saw the ocean through the picture windows, but because he immediately turned to look at the false one, it was difficult to decide what or whom his comment referenced.
And we see later on in that scene that he speaks their language. He is a man who is in many ways sort of like interested in women, right? And that sort of like allows him to be able to like, again, the sort of the use of language and the use of language in a sort of a feminine sense is not exclusive, and it's sort of not determinative of gender here either. It's much more sort of like, it's like a foreign language. It's like, it's something you can learn, as the narrator does, as the seducer clearly has, for different reasons, right? And this kind of like vagueness to it, and this sort of borderness, if you like, really sort of, to me, apart from anything else, accentuates the kind of horror of these moments. It's not really a horror book exactly. It feels a bit like Edgar Allan Poe at times. But it's sort of like, it articulates horror. And I mean, the bit that I read earlier about, men being afraid of women, women being afraid of men, I think that articulates a kind of deeper horror. And a lot of the writing about this book has sort of situated this in a Mexican and a Mexican-American context. And two ways in which it does this are borders on the one hand, and femicide on the other, the killing of women, the mass killing of women.
Maybe it's time to bring in the Amparo Davila, the two Amparo Davilas, the true one and the false one. The idea of the concept of disappearance, which is actually also in a book about a book basic primarily set in or near a hospital, is referred to as a kind of disease.
An epidemic, perhaps? Yes.
What do we mean when we talk about disappearance in this novel?
Well, so I think it's interesting because there are a couple of ways you can separate this. Were this a South American and not a North American book? Certainly within the sort of like Latin American context, you can talk about disappearances in terms of state-organized political forced disappearances.
That's what this book sort of seems to be correct me if I'm wrong, in some cases, in the sense of people who are forcibly rendered to the insane asylum and then commit suicide, one thing it explicitly talks about, but it seems to have at least two other layers.
Yes, and I think particularly this has to do with the mass disappearance and presumed murder of women, particularly around Ciudad Juarez in northern Mexico. If we talk about Rivera Garza's sort of later works, her newest one out is about the disappearance of her sister, which is a sort of particularly brutal personal example of this. And the idea that this is sort of like a societal ill or illness, this disappearance of women, about which she's, you know, written much elsewhere, her being far from the only one. It's sort of something that then infects the whole society, right? And it leads to this kind of disjuncture, if you like. It leads to this fracturing, this sort of gap where all of these women should be. And I think that's where we can kind of situate this idea that, like, oh, well, not only is there sort of like one Amparo Dávila, there are two. I think I said Dávila. I've been putting the accent in the wrong place. It's Dávila. There are sort of two of these women, right? And one of them is the sort of the author in the, you know, a different sort of timeline or a different sort of process of time, and the other is the kind that sort of like invades your house, right? And it's sort of like you can look at that in a bunch of different ways. You can look at that in terms of like a public and a private life. You can think about it in terms of a haunting, which I think this book absolutely does. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, when the narrator discovers this second Dávila, this sort of second woman, this is what sort of sets in motion the sort of middle third of the novella, which is this sort of almost spy story for a second.
he does a little bit of a Mission Impossible thing.
This
is where I wanted to say this is the third layer of the disappearance, which is also that it's important. I think it's significant that Amparo Dávila is an author, and that the subject of the hunt is the manuscript that she has written that other sort of people claiming to be her are trying to keep alive.
Yeah, and it's interesting too, because if you look at the historical Dávila, she, like, you know, much fated in her life, but in terms of her legacy, like, immediately and vastly overshadowed by men. And I think a point that the novella makes very strongly is this kind of misogyny, this kind of erasure of women, whether that happens on sort of like the brutal physical level, whether it happens on the intellectual, academic level, it leads to this kind of fracturing of womanhood that, on the sort of timeline downstream of that, every other woman in that society is the poorer from it. And that might seem like, you know, an obvious point, but the way that it articulates it is such that, you know, one way of reading it is that it sort of robs the narrator of the ability to even know that he is a woman. But it's something that has to be sort of like restored in secret, and it requires you to sort of like break into these institutions and requires you to like find knowledge that was, you know, hidden from you.
That's the again, I only sort of go back to thinking about you talking about the process of, you know, of transing your gender, as you say.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Requires a sort of navigating institutions as though you're walking through rain without getting wet.
Mm-hmm.
And I think how I sort of read that, the breaking into the manuscript as part of the becoming a woman, so to speak, was he always difficult to say?
Yeah, I like that it refuses to give you an answer on that.
Oh, of course, because ultimately, if you give an answer, it just goes back to she was a woman the whole time.
Yeah, exactly.
As opposed to like, no, these concepts in themselves are sort of stupid.
It's why I like using the sort of the he/him pronouns too, but as the novel does, you know. I think this is also very interesting in terms of translation, and this is a book that is less interested than the Tega syndrome and the concept of translation, but still very much so because language, you know, is a preoccupation of Rivera Garza's, and you know, Spanish is a very very gendered language, more so than English, and I find it more interesting and more complicated to talk about, you know, a character with the, you know, the phrase that he is a woman, right, than that she is in that way. Because I think it lends this sort of like air of complexity and this air of interrogation to it that I really like.
Well, because ultimately, right, within the logic of the novel, if it comes down on the side of he is or is not a woman, then that's just applying the same logic of the hospital.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. You can absolutely sort of view it as this is like a woman who does not know that they're a woman. Or you can view it as like this is a man who has been sort of successfully gaslit, right? And who has been, if you like, sort of separated from his manhood and his masculinity by these women who are out to sort of reclaim this manuscript, you know?
So this is by the true Amparo Dávila, an exchange between her and the narrator. And this is after he asks about how come there are all these emissaries out there. How come there are all these young women calling themselves you? She says, "Don't be intimidated by them. They aren't dangerous, you'll see. When they learned of my disappearance some years ago, they got organized. It was back when young women still like to call themselves feminists. Well, these girls took it seriously and formed a group of emissaries from the past. And their mission is, I asked with an irony I wasn't able to hide, to safeguard my words, naturally. You see, dear, if they do vanish, my young followers won't have the means to describe their own experiences on this earth, like you, when you were a tree. By then, I'd had it, and I'd let out a loud, robust guffaw. The story I was hearing was completely ridiculous and, moreover, impossible. Women had never liked to call themselves feminists, as far as I knew, and no one with even the slightest amount of intelligence would waste their time and energy forming an absurd organization to communicate with the past in order to resolve a disappearance that, judging by the obvious presence of my interlocutor, never amounted more to anything than a mere delusion. As much as I wanted to, I couldn't stop laughing, and it continued with the same intensity as the remorse I'd felt only a few minutes before. I again found myself with tears in my eyes, except this time they were not from pain, but self-pity."
It's interesting, isn't it? I think that's a great little encapsulation of the way that sort of patriarchy feels about feminism. As you know, as far as I know, this has never existed, right? And I like this idea of not time travel exactly, because travel implies a sort of volition, but there is a sort of a strangeness of time in the book where, you know, in some sense, because of the various authorities, because of the, you know, the fact that there are checkpoints and soldiers and hospitals, there is this sort of fraying at the edges of time where it becomes sort of uncertain. You know, has it always been like this? Was there ever a feminism? You know, trying to articulate when these things were and when they happened in a society that is so sort of dishonest with itself and so controlling. You know, it's sort of like sand through the fingers, you know, kind of like, and I think also we should talk about the tree thing at this point.
I'm going to admit the tree thing did kind of go over my head.
So, I mean, a tree is a gender, right? I think
what Joe Biden meant when he said at least three.
That's right. Man, woman, tree. I think it's sort of, this is why I wanted to do the Tega syndrome first, right?
I would never have thought, oh, the Tega syndrome, the simpler of the two books to understand.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is sort of analogous in terms of like the it being peak weirdness, the thing that you sort of remember at a remove of the book, you know, to the puppets, and the Tega syndrome is, you know, that he is for a while a tree and experiences sort of like some kind of gender dysphoria around being and not being a tree. Mm-hmm. And we've seen from the Tega syndrome that, you know, trees, you know, en masse or singly can be these sort of like animate, somewhat magical, somewhat like unreal things. There's a long New Yorker review of Rivera Garza's fiction that I'm sort of depending on a lot for this. Mm-hmm. So, if, you know, in a sense, this podcast is kind of like a worse paraphrase of that, which I'm going to quote from.
In conversation!
In conversation with, yes. Detectives, journalists, and anthropologists journey in bewilderment from a city to its outskirts. Arriving in the desert, or the mountains, or the taiga, they discover that men are women are trees, and trees are part beast, part shadow, creeping across the forest floor, indifferent to human intrusions. And I think that's sort of really fascinating, this idea that the thing need not be the thing, right? Whether that's in the context of detective fiction or fairy tale or kind of horror as this is. And what's important is a sort of a sense of coming to know, right? A sense of, if you like, you know, she said wokely, lived experience, right? And ultimately where that leads in this novel is a kind of, I don't know, I find this very helpful in gender terms because we still don't know a lot when this novel ends. Mm-hmm. But what it is it feels to me like a kind of a different level of incomprehension. Mm-hmm. And one that's much more willing to sort of accept ambiguity and accept sort of like limits to knowledge apart from anything else. And it's funny, it's sort of it's ironic that it's in that moment that the narrator sort of remembers the bit of the sort of striated kind of terrain of knowledge that he was like reaching for at the start of the novel, you know, the Iliac crest, now that it's sort of, it doesn't matter anymore.
So is this almost a little bit of reaching back to Timmy Concepts, Tommy Concepts, of thinking about that these kind of distinctions that we draw between, you know, person and tree are in a sense sort of arbitrary? Or am I overthinking it?
You're absolutely right. They're arbitrary, and I think that what the book wants us to ask is, again, like Butler with, you know, gender and power, why are they there? What are they doing? Why do we feel these ways about them? And, you know, why are we sort of like engaged in this idea of like defining and typifying and solidifying all of these things that refuse to be solid?
Says you are trying to define gender by reference to a hip bone, and yet you are not able to tell if you are a person or a tree, let alone a man or a woman.
Yes, yeah, okay. Absolutely.
And I guess you could say the same thing as well about, well, this is my house, but these other people are living it. This is my boss, and yet he seems to be, you know, acting as a friend. All of these
sort of... There's a little bit of communism there, too. Yeah. Just like, yeah, I'm a respectable middle-class professional, and now all of a sudden I find that, you know, I have other people in my house just living there as if they're entitled to do that. Mm-hmm. But yeah, as much as we say that, you know, communism isn't coming for your toothbrush, it might be coming for your apartment. there is another line, which is when he invites the general director to meet these two women. He says, "I was ready to participate in a party, an orgy, a parade, or a march against reality in favor of all its enemies." And I think that's how I would sort of characterize the book, right? And I think it's also an essential part to, although she doesn't make this explicit, the way that Rivera Garza defines gender and also queerness. I think queerness is a sort of like a big part of understanding this book, is sort of an expression of something that need not be typified, or something that exists outside a sort of a boundary or an authority, something that exists outside reality, with the sort of what the kind of reality that a doctor who works in a sort of an asylum trying to assign names to, you know, names to hip bones when he first meets people might have.
So I actually want to talk a little more about the asylum itself, which I found to be a very interesting setting.
Yes.
This is another sort of passage I captured about the hospital. When I would finally open the door to the cold, humid, windowless room that they had the gall to call my exam room, my hatred was such that all I could think about was poisoning my patients. I was not interested in curing them. Again, this went, because of the book's focus on gender, the all I could think about was poisoning my patients, I was not interested in curing them, really does make me think of all of the things you tell me about, like, doing this through the NHS and attempting to...
Sure.
Yeah, a doctor who is actively not interested in, you know, not curing, but treating their patient.
This is kind of the doctor-patient relationship is very interesting to me in this, because you get to see both sides of it, as you do with, well, I say both, as you do with gender, right?
Don't forget the trees!
Yeah, you get to see all at least three sides of this. And I think one of the things that it articulates very, very well for me is the awareness, both as a doctor and as a patient, of the patient being kind of an inconvenience. Mm-hmm. And whether you sort of choose to resent that from either side or what you choose to do with that is sort of like an open question.
Well, if it comes back down to this is a book about collapsing the distinctions between things, then the distinction between doctor and patient or hospital worker and patient or patient and patient really only hurts everybody involved. This goes on. I acted with the firm conviction that the best I could do was expedite their deaths, thereby sparing them the inhumane stupor brought on by a long-term stay in this place. Again, the inhumane stupor could very easily also be happening to him as the doctor.
Yes. Bloody woke hospitals making the nurses patients, the patients doctors.
Yeah, babies are doulas, doulas are babies.
Yeah, I went in for a hip replacement and I had a tree do it.
Oh, you got getting a bloody tree doing the hip replacements. Hip replacement with a bloody elm.
Also very revealing the extent to which this novel has got under my skin that I reached for a medical procedure and the first thing I went to was a hip replacement.
Yeah, I got to get my iliac crest replaced.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I was not the only one. The nurses seemed to share my secret resentment. They manipulated their patients with that calm, tense aggression that only hatred is capable of producing. The administrators, for their part, manifested it through indifference. They spent hours doing nothing but yawning in front of their almost unusable computer screens. The cooks channeled it into foul stews, either flavorless or over-seasoned, that other dazed employees would then serve on metal plates. In the guards, it could be seen not only in their eyes, but also in the weapons they slung arrogantly across their chests. Everybody is unwell in this place.
Yes. Yeah, it is. It is a holistically like sick society, which I really appreciate. Also, you know, as much as we sort of as much as this pertains to a lot of institutions, I would be very interested in hearing from people who read this book, who work in healthcare, particularly in hospital settings. Because I think this really, you know, even the bit that you read, sort of addresses the peculiarities and the sort of strangenesses and the sort of disgusts of a hospital, of an asylum. And I there's a great bit later on, when the narrator is sort of like, is a patient and he kind of like is in bed listing the things that you can do in a hospital bed. One of which is, you know, listing the things that you can do in a hospital bed.
Mm-hmm. That one's a bit of a cop-out. Come on.
And, yeah, it's sort of like counting your own breaths and sort of like thinking about the peculiarly ugly shade of the ceiling and stuff like that. And it's like, I really sort of, I really cherished that. I thought that
was
very well
done. Can I read you the list?
Yeah, please, yeah.
There aren't many things that can be done from a hospital bed, but it is possible. 1, to meticulously examine the ceiling's every detail. 2, to slowly roll from the right to the left side of the mattress, feeling each of its springs and every single wrinkle in the sheets. 3, to identify and suffer from the itchiness that attacks the most impossible parts of the body. For example, the spot on your back where your hand can never reach. To imagine what you will cease doing once your illness disappears and you go home. You say, for example, if I get better and go home, I will immediately evict my guest. I will do it without a moment's hesitation, without a fuss, unceremoniously. I will tell her simply in a firm and even voice, I will appreciate it if you left my house as soon as possible. 5, to immediately regret what you imagine doing or cease doing once the illness disappears and you can go home. 6, to count the number of inhalations and exhalations necessary to stay alive, which of course is a funny one because once you have to keep counting that forever, and when you're done counting, you will be dead.
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. 7, to repeatedly ask yourself, so self-aware, what the right words would be, if any, to describe the light that illuminates and hides and invades the ward. And, you know, this is to be subjected to this. The list goes on. It's like a 40-item list. You know, what is it that the narrator actually does is he tries to read something he shouldn't in the hospital, this manuscript that's that's sort of ambiguously tied to about Juan Escuicha and Amparo Davila, and as his punishment for seeking that knowledge, he has to go be sick but wearing a different outfit, basically.
Yes, yeah, exactly. Very sort of mutable roles, right? And this is something that sort of like we come back to a lot in this novel is exactly how mutable those roles are in a society that like is very, very keen to box you in. It perversely, in some ways, becomes easier to just shift between those boxes because there's sort of like it has less perception of the things outside of them. In a sort of a very, very gendered society, in some ways it's, and again, this is a very, this is like the deep transgender knowledge that sometimes it is easier to be a sort of like a sort of a binary expression of gender in a society that very much prioritizes that than something that is not those things, unless your president is Joe Biden, in which case, you know, he's fully on board with that.
Yeah. So wait, do you just go into that? You say that the deep knowledge is it's easier to us to be, is it easier just to be binary, so you might as well express, so you might as well go further out of the original box and into the other binary?
That's one part of it, yes.
Yeah.
I mean, it puts me in mind of just like, because it's absurd, right? And this is a way of exploring these things through the absurd. It's sort of like going to the gender identity clinic, and, you know, when they ask you the question about, like, do you think of yourself as a woman when you masturbate, demanding that they get up, give you their lab coat, and you switch seats, right? And you just do the back half of that appointment as different people.
I guess that, because that treats that question with exactly as much respect as it deserves.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know what this is? This is yet another, I'd say, broadside. This is something you've mentioned earlier. Something a thread you can draw through a lot of our books. Another broadside at striation and sort of powers, desire to categorize, and the ill effects that has on everybody involved.
When the narrator is a tree, right? So he goes to find the real Amparo Dávila, and she addresses him with, like, the feminine part of speech. In English, I guess you would use, like, she, her pronouns. And goes, yes, you have been a woman, right? But you've also been a tree. And the way in which she, at this point, I guess, experiences being a tree is thinking about my half-buried, half-liberated body, my own ruins, which is, well, there's some gender there, right? And so it's there's something that, like, is half liberated in society, something that is half liberated in being a man, in being a woman, in being a tree for that matter, that sort of leaves you, like, half buried, right? I think that's the thing here. That's the drive towards, or the call towards, queerness, or like a kind of a non-binary sense, right? Or something even beyond that. Of just uncertainty, of sort of radical uncertainty.
We can then say, like, it's at all turns, the narrator is either sort of buried or half buried, whether it is trying to recover his house to just bury himself in his job that he hates again, whether that is buried in the role of the administrator, whether that's buried in the role of a patient, he's never sort of totally expressed at any given point.
Yes. Yeah. And to sort of to dig yourself out of it is to recognize that you can have been a man and a woman and a tree and a bunch of other things. And that it's sort of what matters is not so much the labels that you ascribe to those things as the experience and having had that experience.
So, because I also captured the tree portion.
Hmm.
It says, my leaves grew, my trunk coarsened over time, and clouds and dew clung to my branches. There were birds around me and other imitations of living, warm, sonorous beings, the canvas of my melancholy, and thus on the doorstep where the true one was half appeared and half hidden, sort of a callback there. My life as a tree filled me with an immense sadness. I was ashamed of my solitude, and I didn't know what to do with the remnants of my body, my silence, the tongue that crowded behind my teeth, my own ruins. What I mean to say is that I began to cry unceremoniously before her.
Happens to the best of us.
And the funny thing, right, is that this happens in exactly the same passage when he scoffs at the idea of being a woman.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
Just a couple pages subsequently, we see, anyone with normal vision would realize I had neither breast or a waistline, nor long hair, nor painted nails. Anyone with normal vision would have noticed my facial hair, the broadness of my shoulders, the narrowness of my hips, and the bulge between my legs. Anyone, in other words, besides Amparo Dávila and her horde of emissaries, they were all blind, out of their minds, it's true, and blind. I was fed up. I was fed up with myself, above all, and so I stood up and headed towards the door.
I think what's interesting too, besides Rivera Garza sort of like whispering in your ear there that it's almost as if you don't need to have or not have any of those things to be a woman, right? Is that sort of as your gender and your identity changes because of its relation to power, you kind of experience time differently. And that's a really interesting thing to speculate about. And it's something that, you know, we talked about a bit earlier with this manuscript and these emissaries, that sort of like being a woman, the experience of being a woman and having your sort of like your womanhood censored and taken from you, you know, it changes your like your movement through time in the same way that like being a tree existing on kind of like on plant time, right, presumably does also. And you can kind of feel that in the narrative. I think that's one of the things that I really like and why it's so sort of like finely woven here is the sort of like the sort of manlier moments of the narrator are sort of characterized by this like terseness and this impatience. And the more emotional moments are more feminine, but not in a way that sort of like ever feels reductive.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's
because it doesn't put a label on them. It doesn't define that. It doesn't like typify that, you know?
Mm, yeah. It's that, you know, the tree speaks much longer than the man, and the man is very dismissive and scoffs.
Yes. Yeah.
Likes to storm out and things of that nature.
There's a line too about, the narrator's gender, right? After meeting this true Davalo, he says, "I felt as if I were inside a parenthesis in a sentence written in an unknown language," which is
me too, buddy.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, would you like some of my estrogen? I think almost all of us have felt like this at one point or another. And I think while it maybe has like a different inflection for trans people, I think this is also something which is sort of also reflective of the society, right? This sort of fucked, militarized, authoritarian sort of guard tower society that the narrator is in, that you feel sort of so disjointed that, like, not only do you not make sense to yourself sort of lingually, but you don't make sense to yourself syntactically. You can't sort of identify yourself even as a part of speech, right? And I think whether that's like feeling threatened because, you know, being asked your pronouns asks you to articulate yourself as a part of speech, and that's quite threatening if you don't know. In the same way, just sort of like thinking about this as, feeling like you're inside a parenthesis in a sentence in an unknown language.
If you wanted to even generalize it to some of the stuff about career as, or not career, but like social position as well.
Sure.
You know, it's how uncomfortable everyone is in their, I keep going back to the hospital because that's where I got a lot of sort of some of the more obvious things out of this book.
Sure. There's one thing I wanted to point out very quickly before you start, which I think is going to have a bearing on this, which is more or less the one character in this who does not change gender, changes affect, does not change gender, or rank in this is the director, which is really a kind of like the patriarchy always wins kind of thing.
Well, what I was actually going to say is the director and Juana Squeecha, who is unable to continue living.
Sure.
Who is unable to accept the world around him as it is, who sort of sees how, whether that's politically buried, whether it's sort of socially buried, all these things are, going back to buriedness from the tree, he throws himself into the sea, which is where the narrator is the only place the narrator can find calm while looking at the sea.
And the sea is interesting too, because we're told that it routinely washes up migrants who are trying to sort of like get into this society. You get a bit of a sense of like exactly how it is the way that it is. But it also, there's a moment at the end, right, or towards the end, where he goes to the beach with these two women, and they see inexplicably a seabird just kind of like dive into the sea dead, just like falls out of the sky. And the first time I read this book, I was just like, what does this mean? Why this? And one thing that I think having this conversation has kind of elucidated to me is that's sort of, to me, it's about embracing the absurdity and even the inhumanity of your society, or at least facing it, being able to like see it happen. And at that time, if you do that, then it's kind of an escape in its own way, but it's also sort of more of a, sort of a sense of comprehension.
So when we talk about the sea, right, it's the it is the it's very funny. I misread a portion as saying, and then I got to eat the marine animal, and I was like, now you're talking my fucking language, buddy.
The bounty of the sea.
Yeah, it's
that's
the
right.
Boys
yeah.
Award. But that's it right. is it I for me this in this book, the sea stands in as the unstriated place. Is the place where fantasy goes. The it is in a sure. for the narrator. And for Juan Escuicha as well, who throws himself into it, it is what you refer to as the ideology cube. It is the place beyond the striation. It is the place that they're striving for, where things flow into one another, where ground is not solid, where you're not buried, but also, you know, where you drown as well.
Yeah, absolutely. You know,
that's how I read the sea in the book, anyway.
A place of authenticity is also a place of immense danger, which, again, we come back to femicide, right, and to disappearance, and to disappearing into the sea, even though we have, you know, a man doing that. Interesting. I was referring to Juan Escucha there, but you never know. This is very much a book that rewards the kind of like eyebrow waggling sort of seminar question of like, interesting, do we though?
So you're saying that on the one hand she has written one of sort of kind of the best expressions of like gender and queerness that you know in a literary form.
It's the best book about being transgender I've seen a cisgender person write. Yes,
but also it really rewards a lot of seminar eyebrow raising and then cryptic hand folding. Is it?
Yes, absolutely. I think that's my short review of the Iliac Crest. A short, beautiful book, which I've really appreciated.
And I've appreciated you showing me the writing of Rivera Garza. I've enjoyed it immensely.
Yeah, of course. I'm hoping to read a lot more. There's the limiting factor there is the translation. But you know, I'm hoping that sort of like as both the Iliac Crest and the Tega Syndrome have been sort of like very very well reviewed, justly. That you know, more translations forthcoming, or also I just fucking like you know surrender and learn Spanish.
Oh yeah, I mean. Yeah, that's easy to do. It's not like you're learning any other languages.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, it's not. I mean, it's sort of like I've.
It's not like you're routinely disappointing a polycule-sized amount of Duolingo owls every day.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing is also I've just been on this kick lately where I've so much of the stuff I've been consuming has been Latin American. I've been watching mostly Chilean movies lately for no particular reason. I watched a couple of Pablo Larraín movies, then I saw A Fantastic Woman, which fucked me up emotionally for a couple of days, and is not a transgender a piece of art about being transgender by a cisgender person. That is, you know, something I would recommend. I would recommend cis people watch it, but that's, you know, entirely different thing. But yeah, so I'm sort of like I'm interested in engaging in maybe a whole other sort of hemisphere of culture now.
Would we divide it into hemispheres?
Yeah, and you know what divides those hemispheres is a smooth terrain of the sea. Curious, isn't it? Because this is the great thing about really experimental writing, right? And I see why a lot of people find it frustrating, right? I think particularly if you read the Tega Syndrome, just going into it blind, you would see why a lot of the reviews were like, yeah, I don't really get this one. I don't, you know, or find that it's kind of like it confuses or it irritates me. But I think part of the beauty of it is that it does allow you to sort of to make those connections. And it like, okay, maybe it can get a bit kind of like eyebrow waggling, does it? If you don't have like a theory, if you don't have a theoretical grounding to do that. And I think being sort of like unburied, being sort of like an open experimental queer even literature, the hazard is that it lets you just kind of like shoot off at the mouth about it, like I've been doing for the last hour, and just kind of, you know, not really go anywhere with it and be like, interesting. But if you do have the kind of theoretical tool set, you can make all kinds of interesting connections with it. And I think this is the kind of thing that really rewards a kind of like left-handed kind of like curveball kind of like study of it, where it's like, I'm going to connect it to this other thing that may not be immediately apparent, or this, you know, this other thing in my experience, whatever. And I think that's, you know, the fact that it's a different book, me having come to it and you having come to it, and, like, you know, whoever, you know, of the listeners chooses to read it. And I think that sort of that ability in really, like, experimental literature like this to sort of both sort of challenge and complicate those preconceptions, but also, you know, something that was very important to me early on in film studies was this idea that, like, watching a film, like, takes at least two people, right? Because you are bringing your own meaning to it also. And I think that's very much the case here too.
Oh, absolutely. And this is, it's also a part of my, I was, again, as someone who is, you know, pretty, I think, academically minded, I've never really read that much experimental fiction, partly because a lot of my academic mindedness was a bit strategic. I wanted to always do things in which I would outperform. And so I never did anything that I knew I wouldn't be completely perfect at. And so, yeah, I know. Great. I love the incentive set up by our university system.
Yeah. And the thing is, right, what this book is telling you is just embrace a bit of ambiguity. And I think there's a strategic angle too here, because as much as this is the book podcast within a podcast, it's also quietly the international relations podcast within a podcast. I think there is also some of the sort of other kind of strategy here where, you know, as much as we're talking now about strategic ambiguity, right? I've just had a horrible realization, which is that I could get a $10 trillion grant to study, like queering the security state or something.
That paper's already been written.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah, no, but yeah, this is absolutely the kind of thing that, like,
drone disorientations, how unmanned weapons queer the experience of killing in war, is written in 2015.
Gorgeous. I mean, yeah, sure.
Yeah. I'm not sneering at the paper. I haven't read it.
No. I'm interested to read it, actually.
Fuck it. Why don't we read it for, like, another one of these?
But yeah, maybe. I think the book, you know, has yet to be written on what, like, a queered security looks like, right? And maybe that's a good thing. I don't know. I mean, potentially you can sort of understand security as being the kind of thing that exists, as it does in this novel, to sort of prevent queerness, and, you know, maybe it allows some forms of it, but it prevents others. But
so what, like, that list of traits that he reads off about himself is security for society and security for him. It's security that he stays in the top of the gender binary. It's security for society that it puts everyone in those various binaries that sort of control.
I think you could say that you're secure in your gender, for instance. I think that there's an interesting thing to be done here in terms of, you know, we've talked about smooth and striated terrain. I think there's an interesting kind of, like, nomad science thing to be done here in what, like, queer security looks like, or whether that's a contradiction in terms.
All right, to the queer academics who listen to this, which I assume is probably a fair few.
Yes.
Go forth.
And again, this is a perfect example, right? Because this has ostensibly not much to do with the actual novella, right? But that's a connection that we've been able to draw, and that's because it has this experimental structure. So for good or ill, you know, I'm very grateful.
What I was saying earlier, right, is I'm so unused to experimental fiction that I had to read it very slowly, because because when I read fiction, I tend to look for the plot, the character, what's happening, what do I need to know in order to get this page turned, which I think a way I don't like reading fiction. I think it's a bad habit I've built up over the course of my life. It's why one of the next books we're reading is about how to read fiction, basically. And, you know, it's and the idea that fiction can live outwardly instead of obscuring some set of facts that you're supposed to decipher, but that rather it can, rather than being a code with an outcome that the author knows and you're supposed to deduce, that it can be a kind of set of propositions that can link in with a bunch of other things, as you've mentioned here with that security stuff. That is a way I'm so unused to reading fiction. I think it's made my life smaller.
Well, I'm glad this kind of, like, I hope it helped is the main thing.
Well, every time, what happens every time we do one of these, oh, not every time, what's happened both times we've done one of these, so like Waiting for the Barbarians, that's a little more of a clear work of fiction with a set of themes that can be deduced and evidenced.
Sure.
Right? It's a good piece of work, but it's not particularly ambiguous.
It's not experimental structurally at all.
It doesn't really invite you to bring much in, or if you do, it's going to be complicating, refuting, or building on something. It's not going to be elucidating some new and hitherto unexpected dimension. That right. Both the times we've read Rivera Garza's work, I've gone into the episode thinking, I do not know what the fuck I am going to say. I know the bits that I thought were interesting stylistically. I know the bits that I thought would provoke a fun conversation, but I really do not understand what I think about this book because it's so strange. Because I never think really that I'm allowed to say, oh yeah, security. How does that fit in with this, with all of these sort of binaries that Rivera Garza is talking about? I keep thinking, no, what is the meaning inside? And I keep trying to go deeper inside, essentially.
Sure. Yeah. Well, I hope that sort of part of the function of this has been to like broaden that out a bit. And one thing that I feel, because I have the exact same emotion, right? I go into these with Rivera Garza going like, I don't have notes, right? I don't have any kind of like sense of what I want to talk about. I just sort of go largely spontaneously. And I think that that's made me both a better reader of fiction. I think it's also made me a better podcaster. And I think that, you know, hopefully the audience will agree with us, but, you know, even if not, it's still been sort of like a useful little like self-help session.
Yeah, maybe it's coming back to, do I really need such detailed notes?
Yeah, curious. Yeah. I mean,
it's almost as though I'm trying to separate out what is bad podcasting and use the notes to keep it out, and what is good podcasting and use the notes to keep it in. Weird. Time to not think about it anymore.
Absolutely. Looking forward to no changes in the structure of our successful podcast.
You know, I have notes for tomorrow's episode. We'll be reviewing them tomorrow. They think they're pretty good.
Fantastic.
Anyway, thank you for listening to this, everybody.
Thank you so much. It has been a pleasure.
Always a treat to talk about any kind of book, field of study, movie, maybe one day.
Yeah, I just really enjoyed these conversations because, you know, I'm glad we're friends, and I'm glad that we have an audience that's willing to sort of like reward our bullshit.
Aw, I can say the same thing. These episodes that have reaffirmed that the most. So if you're out there listening saying, aw, we're going to have a non for the audience version of this discussion when the recording stops. Don't worry. Bye, everybody.
Bye.